Every day in America, businesses spend over $200 million in advertising. Why would they spend so much? That is about $74 billion a year. That is more than the gross national product of many, if not most, countries. Why would American businesses feel that it is so important to spend billions of dollars, not even making the product or even delivering the product, but merely marketing the product? And to answer that question, we have to understand, you're really getting into the human, the American psyche, you know, trying to understand what makes America tick and how Americans think. Advertisers make a living based on that science. As one man, Henderson, writes in his book Culture Shift, there has been a huge shift in advertising over the last number of decades. Advertising began with an emphasis on communicating information. The goal of the advertisement was to communicate information so that people would understand what this product could provide. But then over the years, it shifted from communicating information to that of persuasion, to persuading you as the average citizen that you need this item, whether you think you need this item or not. And then it went from information to persuasion to now, Henderson describes it as manipulation. You'll see an example of this in your notes there in your bulletin by Clark, The Want Makers, the author of The Want Makers. Today, advertising is the product. What people are buying, whether it's drink, jeans, medicine, or electronic gadgets, is the perception of the product they have absorbed from advertising. What does he mean by that? In other words, advertisers are not trying to communicate a product in the sense of what this thing can do or not do. Advertisers are trying to communicate an image. And if they can get you to buy this image, selling the product is no problem. What do we mean by that? Have you ever seen an ad where they don't even show the product? These are real popular now. They'll show a bunch of dancing people jumping around, young, attractive people, and then at the end, they'll just put the name of the product, which has nothing to do with young, attractive people dancing around, but they are trying to communicate an image that if you want to be like this, then you're going to need this product to be like this. And Americans head for the store. So it's much more than merely when an American buys drink or jeans or medicine or whatever, toothpaste. It's not just that they're buying that product, but that they're buying success or attractiveness or health or whatever it is that advertiser wants to communicate, that you need this in order to have this lifestyle. This is obvious in a number of different areas. You can see this even in fine eating establishments. When you know you're in a fine eating establishment, a fine eating restaurant, when the plate is large and the food is small and there are drizzles all over the plate. And you think, I came to eat food, but that's not what it's about. It's all about what? Presentation. Presentation. It's the color match scheme has to be correct. And the stuff may taste like garbage, but it looks good. And that's when you know you're in a fine restaurant. Corinth was no different than that. Packaging was crucial. Advertisement and style and form was more important than truth or content. With that in mind, let me give you a couple examples. They even had restaurants in Corinth where they had rhetoricians, speakers, orators who would speak while the people, while you were waiting for the next course of your meal. They had powerful orators who would speak, try to compete for the crowds at social gatherings and at political rallies. Your ability to communicate yourself was crucial to climbing the ladder in Corinth. It's the same today, isn't it, in our country? You can get a cruddy product, and if you market it properly, it will sell. You can get a good product and you market it poorly, it will not sell. Packaging is everything. With that in mind, as to how we are as Americans and as how Corinth was in similar ways, how would the gospel go over in a culture like that? Chapter 1, verse 18, Paul says that the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those of us who are being saved, it is the power of God. What? You've got this. This is his message. It was a message, literally, the word of the cross, which divides people in two, and on one side, there are those who are perishing, and they view this message as foolishness, lunacy, absurdity. And then on the other side, you have those who are being saved, and they view this message as power, the power of God. How can that be? Well, Paul's going to answer that in this section number 1, verses 19 through 25. He explains that we're moving into totally different categories. You've got to understand the strategy of God. It's unlike the strategy of man. See, with man, packaging is everything. With God, look what it says in verse 21. For since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God. In other words, if you try to get to God using normal human vehicles, that of wisdom, success or achievement or even intensity or sincerity, he said, you're going to miss it. The world has never found God through his mind. His brain is not big enough to span the gulf between earth and heaven. It's totally different ways to get to God. And that's the message of the cross. God came to us. Secondly, he goes on after describing the strategy of God, he talks about the status of God's people. You'll see the message of the cross illustrated in viewing a local church. If it is a biblical local church, you will see certain things. Verse 26, for you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called. In other words, when you look at a typical local church, he is saying, you look at yourselves at Corinth, or you come here to the United States, which is amazing, thousands of years later, the same thing is still true, that you're not going to see an elite social club made up of people who have everything in common. You will see a vast diversity of economic and intellectual and academic backgrounds. He says, not many noble. There will be some noble. There will be some high-standing politicians, some well-educated individuals, but then there will also be others. In Corinth, the church was made up of slaves as well as some wealthy families we see recorded in the book of Corinthians. You say, why is that? Because unlike your typical club, you know, man-centered club, and especially back in Paul's day, those clubs were made up of people who had everything in common, and you had to have a certain status and a certain amount of money and a certain academic ability to get in the club. He says the church is not like that. God does not call that way. He reaches out irrespective of who we think we are and what we think we can obtain, and he saves, he calls people from totally different backgrounds. We looked at that last Sunday night. Thirdly, let me give you the reason for this, as we saw last Sunday night, verse 29, that no flesh should glory in his presence. In other words, the church is a flesh-free zone. No one can say, I got into a relationship with Jesus Christ because I'm somebody, or I paid an amount of money, or I achieved a certain amount of intelligence, and I'm smart enough to choose God. He says, nah, that's not how you got in. No flesh should glory in his presence. That way, verse 31, he who glories, let him glory in the Lord, as we just heard sung about. I boast no more. There's nothing to boast about. If you have a relationship with God through Christ, you have no basis of boasting. It eliminates the whole flesh thing. It eliminates status. It eliminates comparing ourselves among ourselves, because we're all nobodies before Him, and we're all somebodies in Him, and it's all through Him and to Him and for Him. Changes all our categories completely. So He illustrates it with the church themselves. And then He turns, and this is where we pick up this morning, in verse 1 of chapter 2. He turns to His own communication, His own preaching. He is saying, my preaching is an illustration of the word of the cross. In other words, the way I preach is as significant as what I preach. What is He talking about? Look at verse 1. And I, brethren, when I came to you, did not come with excellence of speech or of wisdom, declaring to you the testimony of God. So Paul here is talking specifically about when he walked into Corinth and he started preaching the gospel in Corinth, a place that had never heard the gospel. What was his communication style like? When I read that, I say, I want to know. What a pattern he lays out here for what a typical church teaching, communication, Christian communication should be like. Number one, it was not fun to listen to. It was not fun to listen to. Look what he says there. When I came to you, did not come with excellence of speech. And when I say fun to listen to, I mean it wasn't, as Thistleton writes, high-sounding speech. It wasn't dazzling rhetoric. In other words, when Paul preached, he didn't leave you with this fuzzy, warm feeling like, wow, that guy could really communicate. And as you walked out the door, you wouldn't be saying to someone next to you, man, that guy is a speaker. Or if you go to a Christian concert where someone's ministering through song, and you know how sometimes you'll walk out saying, what a voice. And other times you walk out saying, what a God we serve. Huge difference. Huge difference. I mean, both could have great voices, but there's something about word of the cross communication that does not draw attention to itself. It draws attention to Him. And that's what he's talking about here. I didn't come with that kind of eloquence that would leave you dazzled with my ability to put together phrases and words and send you off talking about that. Actually, number two, it wasn't even designed to impress the elite. It wasn't designed to impress the educationally elite. Because he says, I did not come, verse 1 of chapter 2, did not come with excellence of speech or of wisdom. And by that, he means, he's not trying to dumb us down here. He's not trying to say, don't use your mind. When you get into Christian things, you've just got to, you know, turn your brain off and be dumb. And God will do something in your life. No, he's not negating the intellect. He's writing an epistle here. You know? He's using logic to communicate his point here. So he's not ignoring the fact that we have to use the brains that God has given us. What he is saying is that the communication I'm giving is a message that is not based on human wisdom. And it's not communicated in such a way that would draw attention to itself. See, the Corinthians were all up in arms and dazzled by what speaker could use a certain rhetorical style to be able to grab the audience and sweep them into where he wanted them to go. And Paul said, that wasn't my goal at all. No reporter would have gone away from hearing the Apostle Paul saying, you've got to hear this guy, because he can take all the philosophers and he can weave them into a cohesive whole that will just lock in on your mind, and you will be convinced by his logic. He said, no, it wasn't of that kind of wisdom. Nor was it thirdly. Oh, before I get to the third one, let me comment on the end of verse 1. He says it was not with excellence of speech or of wisdom, and he gives us a hint what it was. We're just going to comment on that quickly and then see in more detail what he meant by that. Declaring to you the testimony of God. Declaring to you the testimony of God. Now that word, there's a textual question there. It could be mystery, it could be testimony. If it's mystery, then he's talking about the fact that to those who are wrapped up in themselves, the gospel is going to be an enigma. It's going to be a puzzle. It's going to be a mystery. C.S. Lewis has some great stuff on this. As an Oxford professor, he would often write trying to convince his peers of the transformation that had come over his life. And he said, when I wrote in simple terms, they would ridicule me for being childish. And so then when I would write a complete treatise of what Christianity means, they would ridicule me for being too sophisticated or too complicated. We don't understand what you're saying. And you get that kind of thing, right? I mean, for people whose hearts are caught up in themselves and they've prejudged against God, it doesn't matter what kind of logic you use. It will be a mystery because God has to open their eyes. There's that possibility. He's communicating that. The other option is the word testimony, which I think has a little bit more textual support. What is he communicating when he says, declaring the testimony of God? What he means by testimony is simply that, a matter of fact, a witness. If you walked into a restaurant and you saw this guy come running through the doors and club the clerk with a stick and steal the money and run out the door, and you were to call the police and the police came to you and said, what happened? And you started onto an eloquent, speech about crime and punishment and social injustice and the inequities of this country that lead to people with big sticks hitting other people. And you're going on and on about this, and the officer's going to say to you what? Just the facts. Just the facts, sir. Just the facts, ma'am. I mean, crime and punishment speech is great for some other time, but we need the facts. What happened? That's what Paul is saying. When I came to you, my goal was not to dazzle you with my, dizzying intellect. My goal was simply to communicate the facts. I have seen a resurrected Lord. I have seen the prints on his hand. I have seen his power to change my life. Paul killed Christians for a living. I mean, he went off to work every day to see if he could kill some more Christians. He was antagonistic against Christianity. He was not a fan of Christ. And he met the risen Lord who had been crucified for him. His life was transformed, and he wanted to tell everybody he could about him. And that's what constituted his preaching. Let me tell you the testimony of Jesus Christ. That's what he came to say. So the vehicle in which he communicated that, the preaching was not the end in itself. The style was irrelevant, he said. My goal was to share with you what God has done for me. He gives us a third clue as to what his preaching was not in verse 4. If we skip down to verse 4, first half. And my speech and my preaching were not with persuasive words of human wisdom. So number 3, they were not formulated to convince the cynical. He's basically saying the same thing, but with that word persuasive, he's adding a little dimension. In other words, if you were at that crime scene and you called the police and they came and you started describing this man with the big stick and the police officer stopped you and said, no, just tell us what happened. And you go back through it again, and you tell the guy about the big stick who's real angry and hitting him. And he said, no, tell us what happened. And come to find out, after going in circles for a while, you realize that the police officer doesn't believe in crime. He believes all men are good, all women are good. People are intrinsically good. And they wouldn't do anything like that. So it doesn't matter how many times you tell him what the big guy with the big stick did, he has already prejudged that that can't happen. So it's no longer just a testimony of fact. It becomes you're dealing with a cynic. Someone who has already decided in his small mind and sphere of understanding that's this big, that reality, which is infinite, infinitely huge, can only be this. And that his mind has analyzed all the options and he knows for a fact that these are the only options. That's a cynic. And Paul says, my preaching was not designed. It is not airtight. It will not logically convince someone who doesn't want to know. It because Paul believed that was something much deeper, that God had to change the heart and the mindset of a person like that, and that logic, human logic, could not in and of itself transform someone who was a cynic. So his communication was not these three things, and it was this one thing. Look what he says in verse 2. For I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. This was my communication. You want to know what I came to do? Do you want to know my whole focus when I walked into the city of Corinth? And you can imagine that would be a pretty intimidating thing to do. You walk into a city that had never heard the gospel, and you want to come in and proclaim that a crucified criminal can save you. And Paul looked around, and he could have very easily been intimidated by the academic elite at the Pantheon, all the philosophers. Or he could have very easily been intimidated by all the orators and the speakers and the rhetoricians who were so eloquent. But he said, when I walked down the streets of Corinth, when I came to you, I had only one goal, and that was to make Christ known. That's it. To know him. Look what he says there. I think it's interesting that he determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. It's not just that he said not to preach anything among you, not to know anything. Both in my heart and in your heart, this is all about Jesus. That's what I long for. And I could come and I could convince you that I was academically trained, and Paul was. He was academically trained. He was well trained. He was a very intelligent individual. He says, I could come and I could try to dazzle you with my logic or try to convince you that I am somebody, and I would have failed. Why? Because the only one thing I wanted to do was to communicate Jesus Christ. That's it. I had firmly resolved that that was my goal. Is that our goal? Is that our goal? We have a choice to make, folks. We really do. And for me, I know many years ago when I read that quotation that's in your bulletin next, written by Denny, this thing really grabbed my heart. It hit me like a 2x4 in the head. Denny said that no man can give the impression that he himself is clever and that Christ is mighty to save. Wow. In other words, you take, I'm clever, I'm successful, I'm smart, I can do it. You put all these on one side, and then you put Christ is mighty to save, and then God is going to say to you, choose one. Which side do you want to go? Because you can't stand up, if you're talking about preaching, you can't stand up in the pulpit or in a Sunday school class or as a shepherding group leader. You can't stand up there wanting people to be impressed with you and yet wanting to communicate that Christ is mighty to save. The two don't mix. Either Christ is the only way to salvation and he saved you completely apart from yourself and you have nothing to boast in, or you have something to boast in. One or the other. They cannot mix. Can you imagine what this would do to us if this really grabbed hold of us? Can you imagine if people went to work with one goal, to know Christ and to make him known? What keeps us from sharing what God has done in our hearts? So often it is because we are really concerned about what other people think. I mean, I want Christ to be known, but I also don't want to feel stupid or incompetent or for people to think that I'm weird. You know? I mean, I really want Christ to be exalted in all that he's done for me, but I still want people to think I'm kind of cool and clever. And he's saying, no, no, no. You got to choose one. And once you choose one, it is so freeing. It is so freeing. Because then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what people think. Do you realize what that would do for us? Some of you who are scared to death, you've been saved for years and you have a ton of information in your head, but you're scared to death to lead a shepherding group because you think there's no way I could have all the answers. What if somebody asked me a question I didn't know? What if I didn't have everything ready? What if I looked dumb? And he said, it doesn't matter. What's your goal? To look good or to communicate Christ? Same thing. Some of you are very gifted and you're burdened and you sense God may be calling you to the mission field, but you're like, no, what if I didn't know how to do everything just right? And what if? And we're paralyzed by that, aren't we? Paul says, no. If this is your goal, that I just want to know Christ and make him known, that his crucifixion is everything to me, it is so liberating. Because even if everybody thinks you are a dork, and even if everybody thinks you are unsuccessful or primitive, archaic, or non-intellectual, that's okay. There's no fear of man. Because it's all about him. Wow. For I'm determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. If we could grab a hold of that, that could grab a hold of us, you would be liberating over 1,000 worshipers here who would just invade this community in a way that would be hard to imagine. You say, well, how would I do that? You know, I don't know the strategy. I've never been to seminary. I've never been to college. I don't know all these things about, you know, what to do or what not to do. Well, Paul gives us a great example as to what his manner was like in verse 3. I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling. Wait. Maybe there's a textual problem here. You know, because if you take a good course on preaching, they're not going to say, now the first thing you need to do is get weak. And the second thing you need to do is be scared to death. You know? Be scared to communicate. Don't like getting in front of people. And the third thing is you got to learn how to tremble. You got to be really afraid. And then, and only then, will you be qualified to go into the ministry. We got a bunch of people to be ready to go, right? That's what he's saying. Do you feel competent for the ministry that God has called you to? If you do, you've just disqualified yourself. Imagine Paul walking into the city of Corinth. There's many explanations for why he may have been in fear and trembling. You know, one is his eye ailment. You know, there were times where there's some evidence in the New Testament in different places where he suffered from great eye pains and you know, stuff oozing out of his eyes and all that, which is really hard to communicate with somebody you've never met when you look like that. I know I have allergies, and sometimes my eyes will get all, you know, red and stuff coming out, and it's like you just love to sit down and have a conversation with someone like that when they're going, what is going on in your eyeball? I mean, that may be part of it, in weakness and in trembling, because there's something there. Or he may have suffered from epileptic fits. There's pages and whole books written on this, different evidence from the New Testament that may point to that. Or what I think it probably is just look at his daytimer, Paul's daytimer, as to where he had been in the weeks before he came to Corinth, the months before he came to Corinth. I mean, he had come from Philippi. What happened to him in Philippi? He was beaten and imprisoned. So then he went on to Thessalonica. And he was persecuted there. Then he went on to Berea, and he was persecuted there. Then he went on to Athens, and they practically laughed him out of the place. Oh, that would really boost the old self-esteem, wouldn't it? To where, hey, come on, Corinth, we're going to take you by storm. You know, by the time he got to Corinth, he was probably pretty wiped out. Here we go again. You walk into the city, and anybody want to beat me? I mean, you would get to that point where you would wonder, what am I doing? And so Paul did not ride into town, you know, with this air of, I'm going to conquer another city. What we're dealing with here is a man who was broken, who knew that God had called him to a ministry that he was totally incapable of performing. And that, and see, when we get a glimpse of that, we're getting real close to what the cross really means. As Brooks wrote, I think it's there in your bulletin, never allow yourself to feel equal to your work. If you ever find that spirit growing in you, be afraid. Be afraid. As Isaiah 66:2 says, but on this one I will look, on him who is poor and of a contrite spirit. The word contrite means broken. And who trembles at my word. Do we tremble at his word? When God's word is preached or when we read it on our own, are we utterly convinced that this is God's word for me and whatever else I have on my agenda, whatever else I think is important, I tremble at that word? God is saying those are the kind of people he looks on. And he does something. Because this is the amazing part, and here we're getting really close to understanding what the word of the cross means. Because if you read verse 3, I was with you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling, and my speech and my preaching were not with persuasive words of human wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. Do you just read that over? Do they sound like just Christian words to you? Think about it. That contradicts everything you believe. If you're a typical American, that weakness plus fear plus trembling equals spirit and power. Do we believe that? No. We've been taught, we have whole classes now in our schools on self-esteem. And you've got to be convinced that you can do it, right? Because weakness plus fear plus trembling equals failure. And what Paul is saying is, no. This is the message of the cross. That someone who hung in utter weakness and fear and trembling produced unthinkable results. And the same way is true with Christian communication. That when we are utterly convinced that we cannot do it, that all the human techniques will not do anything unless the Spirit, through His power, does His work. This passage is one of the passages on my sabbatical that God just really grabbed my heart with and said, this is where you guys are at. This is where our church is at. Do we really believe that this is the way to spirit and to power? Do we even want spirit and power? I think a lot of us get used to, we get very comfortable with the fact that what is church? Church is you go, you sit down and somebody preaches at you and you close your Bible and you go home and you feel a little better about yourself. But what breaks my heart is that there are people who have come for months or years to North Hills Community Church and the Word has done absolutely nothing to change your life. I'm not satisfied with that because I know God is not satisfied. I know you're not satisfied with it. That's not what this is about. It's not about just us performing our religious duties so we can feel better about ourselves. That's not the message of the cross. The message of the cross utterly crushes us. We don't leave feeling better about ourselves. We feel crushed. That I am incompetent. I cannot do this. I cannot love my wife like Christ would love his church. I cannot love my neighbors as myself. I cannot live to the glory of God when everything inside my mind wants to lift myself up. God, you're going to have to do a work on my life that only you can do. And if he's going to do it in this place, he's going to be the one that does it. A preacher can't do it. Elders can't do it. Programs can't do it. Sunday school classrooms can't do it. God has to do it. If we believe this, what will this do to us as a church? It'll radically change what we think is a priority. Prayer meetings suddenly become the most important meetings in the church because you realize, Lord, if we're going to see your spirit and your power, then we have got to get on our knees and we got that posture of dependence and we've got to beg you to do your work. We can't do it in our timing. We can't make it happen when we want it to happen. We can't plan the bulletin well enough to manufacture spirit and power because it's going to come through weakness, through fear, and through much trembling. Which is just utter dependence on God. Folks, this kind of mindset is so opposite of what our culture believes. It is so opposite even of what our Christian community believes. You go on a website and you look up for a woman who's in a tough marriage with a husband who doesn't love her, is not treating her as Christ would treat his church. And you look for help on that website. This is an actual Christian website. And it said that if your husband's not loving you like he should, then you need to stop. Don't clean the house. Don't look good. Don't cook for him. You're rewarding him. I'm thinking, wait. Okay, so what we're saying is we want our husbands to become godly, so we're going to act ungodly to get him godly. You know, this is the way we think, right? That we have to stick up for ourselves. And then somebody will say, well, wait, what are we supposed to be, a doormat? Do you think this is talking about being a doormat? This is talking about spirit and power. This is talking about a kind of power that some of you have never experienced before. Because you're so afraid of the doormat thing that you're fighting to hold your life. And Christ said, if you keep your life, you're going to lose it. But if you lose it for my sake, you'll find it. That what results from dying to self is not doormat and people stomping on you and weakness, but it results in power, life-changing power, and suddenly habits that have dominated you forever through weakness, fear, and trembling, you dominate because it's all God. It's his power. It's a totally different way of living, a totally different way of thinking. And if someone doesn't have, as we're going to see in the weeks to come, doesn't have the Spirit of God working in their hearts, it's going to make no sense at all. It's going to sound like suicide. And people go away thinking that it's suicide. It's ludicrous. It's archaic. I think we need to shift what we really want as a church. Evangelical churches or fundamental churches are typically known as good teaching churches. You know, you got to teach the Bible, and that's what's emphasized. Charismatic churches are often known as power churches. You know, I saw one the other day, Powerhouse Ministry Church. You know, the word power is all over them. And when you go, there's an electricity there and excitement and power. Things are happening and popping and, there's all this kind of emotion. And you go to typical evangelical church and it's more cranium. You know, we've got to learn and grow. And what God is saying here is no. This dichotomy is a false dichotomy. When you really understand the word and you tremble at his word, it will result in power. That doesn't minimize the need for solid teaching and doctrine. We cannot move on that point. Otherwise, you get what you get when you get a little kindling and you light it on fire. It burns really fast. And then what happens? It dies. That's just emotion. We have no desire to whirl people up into a whirlwind of emotion. Emotion as an end in itself, Paul rejected that. You can see this in that passage. It wasn't just about miracles and that kind of thing, because he even said the Jews seek after signs. That's a dead end. You can never get enough. You'll become addicted to it. So what are we supposed to do? It comes through the cross. We need to seek Christ. Through the brokenness and the weakness of the cross, when we see ourselves as we really are before God, and he starts transforming marriages, he's doing it. Last night at prayer meeting, I was just shocked as I'm listening to just a few testimonies of what God is doing, and they all reflect this same thing. Man said last night that the greatest thing God has ever done in his life is to give him cancer. I mean, he said, I have come to know God in a way I've never known him. You think, that's crazy. It's the way of the cross. Read Linda, Mike and Linda Kwok's email from Australia. See that exact same thing. Through horrific difficulties they've gone. And now all of a sudden, God is just exploding in their midst. I mean, people are getting saved. Some guy just donated $100,000 anonymous to their church. We've been praying for years for that, for them, so they can buy that property all around their house. I mean, their church that they had been, everybody had been closing in on them. And just God miraculously did that work through weakness and fear and through trembling. There's so many examples of God doing this in our midst and around the world. And the question is, why does it have to be that way? I mean, don't you wish God had chosen another formula to get us to the power side? Well, the reason is when we understand the goal in verse 5. That your faith should not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. What God wants to do at North Hills Community Church is to bring us to a place where we have no one else that can get the credit for what he does. That there is no preacher, there are no elders, there are no teachers, there are no leaders, there are no people. There's no one who can say that the reason God is radically changing us from the inside out is because of this program or this person. It is because none of us can depend on the wisdom of men, but only on the glory of God. That's his point. That no flesh would glory in his presence. That's what we want. Is that what you want? Do you want to see that demonstration of the Spirit and power? I have no idea what that looks like. It may be just a quiet working in hearts that have been dormant for so many years, just floating along, happy to make money and go through the weekly routine. But man, if you're going to talk about God just really radically changing my life, I don't want that. I'm okay with going to church. But I just want to walk back out the same as I walked in, okay? And God is saying, no, that's not the way of the cross. Let him break you. And you will experience a power that you've never experienced before through his Spirit. Do you want that? I hope you do. I hope you do.